Good morning, everybody. Welcome in this beautiful time in the fall. It seems like just a day or two ago, the polar vortex really let us know that fall is here and winter is coming, and that the seasons are serious about it. There's something very interesting to me about the fall. It's there's the beauty of the leaves and the beauty of the cool and clear energy flowing in, and it's also has this edge of I don't know, simple seriousness about it, and I don't know exactly what I mean by it, but it's a sense of you know, this is how it is. So I noticed that we're about halfway between Halloween and Thanksgiving. So something about that arc, I don't know, feels beautiful and appropriate. So for Halloween, what is actually happening? It feels like it's a time when the when the walls between this world and other worlds get a little bit more thin, when we get in touch with perhaps aspects of ourselves that we don't really see or show or are in contact with the rest of the year. So, and then we just take that energy on and sort of dress up as that and really take that on as if this is really us. So, you know, if you go around, there are, you know, you may see, you know, people dressed in superhero costumes. So this is the me that is strong and invincible, you know, taking on, embodied, fully embodied, and really revealed to ourselves and the world. Or maybe there are other parts that, you know, are scary, and that we don't usually like to see or dare to see the rest of the year. And so perhaps we dress up as, you know, whatever scares us. Maybe ghosts or ghouls or... it's interesting that I'm blanking on the name. or, you know, anything, you know, sort of the worst thing that you could imagine meeting, and you dress up as that, and you really fully embody the thing that you're otherwise, you know, really afraid and scared of. Or maybe there's really a peace in your heart, in yourself, that, you know, is really beautiful. And that... you know, you sort of tamp down and don't give it the space the rest of the year. It's a little bit shy, perhaps. And then on Halloween, you know, you dress up as, you know, a beautiful princess or as, you know, a fantastically imaginative fairy or as, you know, an animal or as, you know, really the beauty of, you know, of yourself. And you take that on, and you dress it up, and you go out there and you say, look, look. So the pieces of ourselves, perhaps the energy in our heart that doesn't get so much screen time or air time the rest of the year. There's a koan on this that may be helpful, interesting to look at together. It's from the Mumonkan case 35. Senjo and her soul are separated. And the case goes like this. Goso asked a monk, Senjo and her soul are separated. Which is the true one? So, usually in the old texts, you know, people knew, people had an idea who the Senjo is, so really just this one line, this one question would be enough for a koan, but let me fill you in a little bit on what the story actually is. So in ancient times, there was Senjo, a young girl who grew up, and there was a playmate of hers, a boy named Ochu. And they grew up together, and they played together, and at some point, her father sort of jokingly mentioned, ah, you know, the two of you, it looks like, you know, you're really made for each other. Maybe eventually at some point, you know, you will get married and, you know, have a family together. And so indeed, as they grew up, they fell in love, and in their minds, they were going to be together. But then, as it turns out, her father had completely forgotten about what he had mentioned in jest. And when it came time to, well, when he thought, or her parents thought, that it would be time to marry, they looked for someone suitable, who turned out not to be Ochu. And both of them were deeply distressed about that, because they had thought that this was actually the reality, this was what was going to happen. And yet, all of a sudden, there were these very different expectations. So Ochu was so distressed the night before the wedding was supposed to be, he packed his stuff in the middle of the night and left town and just went away. He just couldn't bear being in the same space with her and not being able to be with her. And then along the side of the road, he meets Senjo. And they hug and they connect and they elope together. And they go to a different place, and they get married, and they have a family, and they have two kids, and they live their lives. And then at some point, there's this niggling unease. And Senjo at some point says, I think we should go back. We should go back to my parents. We should ask them for forgiveness for running away. And as you can imagine, this being China, where there is really a strong culture of filial responsibility to your parents, that running away was not an easy thing to do. Opened a rift. So they pack up their stuff, they return to the town where they grew up, and sort of in the opening move in sort of the diplomatic rapprochement, Ochu at first says, you know, I'll go talk to your parents, I'll talk to your father alone first, so you stay here, I just go. And he goes up and he's very apologetic and he asks for forgiveness and he says, you know, I'm so sorry that, you know, Senjo and I ran away and that we didn't get your permission and that we got married without your consent, against your wishes, and I ask you for forgiveness. And then the father says, I don't know what you're talking about. Senjo is here. She fell ill the evening before our wedding, and she has taken to bed all this time, and she hasn't spoken in years. But she's here, but she's ill. And Ochu says, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, we've been living together. And so, you know, the father brings him inside into the chamber, and indeed, there is Senjo in her bed, sick. And quiet. And so Ochu wants to return to the other Senjo and somehow, I don't know, you know, communicate, figure out what is actually going on here. And at the same time, Senjo, who has come from outside of the city, sort of feels moved to come closer to the house. And the Senjo, who had been in bed, you know, got up and headed out. And then in the middle of the road, the Senjo who had left and the Senjo who had been left behind approached each other and embraced and became one. So who's the real Senjo? The one who stayed behind? Who followed her father's wishes? Or the one who ran away and had a family? Which is the real one? And as usual in koans, the question is not about Senjo. So who's the real you? And what are the situations in your life where there are pieces that have been split off? There are pieces that we're unwilling to see that have been exiled. There are pieces in ourselves that we're not willing to see or feel or experience or give space, where it doesn't feel safe to let that come out, and where we have separated a piece of ourselves. And looking around, you have spent significant time on the cushion, so perhaps you have experienced that as we sit, as we settle, as we quiet down, the shy and quiet voices speak up. It's like in the jungle in there. Once things get quiet, you know, the animals that are very, very shy, you know, do come out. And I think for me, it's especially on retreat where I realize that it actually takes a lot of continuous effort and energy to keep those unwanted things at bay. And where when the space and the quiet opens up and the stability and a sense of safety and relaxation, the efforts of the holding things at bay exhausts itself. And there it is. So we may meet the fear that is in our hearts. The things that we have pushed away because we're afraid of them. And there they are. Or there are the pieces where we realize, oh, this is actually a great strength of mine that I have not connected with or allowed myself to really fully embody. Huh. Look at that. There it is. Or maybe there are aspects that are beautiful, that are really who at the deepest place of our heart is really who we are. And yet that beauty has not been allowed to shine. And there it is. And then what? For myself, there is sort of a a part of the landscape of my mind, of the way I run my life, that is sort of the vigilant fixer. It's like scans, danger, danger, danger. This is right. This is wrong. This should be like this. This should be like that. Let me do this in order. This is. So it's easy at that point when things open up for the. For our habitual strategies to jump into place and do whatever it is that they have learned to do. And it, for myself, it took a long time for me to see that that was actually operating and at work. It felt like the step from seeing that something is there that is painful to look at, painful to see, painful to acknowledge, to actually making the jump to this is wrong and this must go away, and what do I do to do that, it felt like this was all one thing. It wasn't visible that actually, if there is some more space around it, these are different stages in that development. So again, to notice the separation in the vigilant fixer. Because the vigilant fixer is really based on making distinctions between right and wrong and what should be here and what should not be here and making plans and doing what it has learned to do in order to keep this one safe. There's actually also nothing wrong about the vigilant fixer. What a novel idea. But to see when it's operating, to see it as an energy that moves in, that believes that separation and control is a way of living this life. Of having to live this life, perhaps this way. If you ask it, that's probably honestly what the vigilant fixer believes. And yet, it's only a small separate part. Many other parts. So one, I guess, big discovery for me in this has been that that actually the quality of how I be with what comes up is important and makes a big difference. So, and I can sort of notice that in my body. So, the vigilant fixer is tight and ready. And has a lot of energy over here. And it does not have a lot of kindness in it. So what I noticed is that when the tightness happens, I can invite myself to relax. And And then noticing again when the tightness comes back and inviting it to relax. When things show up that I don't like or that I think shouldn't be there, to wonder, huh, what would it be like to approach this, to see this, to receive this with kindness, with friendliness? Noticing there's actually nothing wrong about the vigilant fixer. And that the vigilant fixer is not who I am. It's an energy that is active at some time, and then at other times, other energies are active. And to really turn towards it with the question, what do you really want? What do you really need right now? What does the vigilant fixer really want? What does the vigilant fixer really need? And we may be able to see that actually there's something underneath that as well. That there is a fear. And that the vigilant fixer is there to somehow keep that fear at bay and keep control of the situation. So I don't have to be afraid. So I don't have to feel insecure. I don't have to feel anxious. Yet it's a lot to ask of this poor fellow to actually keep me safe. How could the vigilant fixer ever keep me safe? What a humongous task. It's like the anxious energy is built right into it. Because if you look at reality, it's not so easy to control, if you haven't noticed. And then when, I don't know, there was sort of a sense of curiosity and of kindness and of goodwill, then all of a sudden things can shift, things can open up in a way that felt very tight and closed before. So this kindness and this energy of love and openness is really what I'm most curious about these days. And it's not something that I've seen a lot in the Zen literature, but if you look closely, it's not that it isn't there. And in meeting face to face. I remember Roshi Enkyo at some point, you know, at the beginning of retreat, like there is, you know, she goes around with Jundo, and, you know, you're sort of supposed to, you know, be at attention, and she, it for the longest time, it felt to me like, you know, she was coming around inspecting her troops. So there was a certain, you know, martial energy with that. And I remember at some point in one of her Dharma talks, she talked about how it feels like from her perspective. And I forget exactly how she put it, but essentially it's she's walking around overwhelmed by the dedication that people put into sitting down on the cushion So for in her experience, it's just love is just flowing out. Love and appreciation. Very different energy, right? Outwardly, the same event. So, and the other thing I've been curious about is how the separation does not just exist in ourselves. If we look around, there's a lot of separation going on, a lot of anger and division that comes with it. So settling on the cushion, being open to welcome and face what comes up with kindness and curiosity is one approach that works for me on this cushion. What would that look like for a society? I don't know. But I'm curious. I'd like to close with a poem by Derek Walcott. Love After Love. He writes, "The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door. In your own mirror. And each will smile at the other's welcome. And say, sit here. Eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you. The stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life.